First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, welcome to the BS Report. Attica. I couldn't resist. For my guest today, somebody that we did not have in the first year of the BS Report, and I really don't know why, because she's one of my favorites, and we're going to have her on right now from Page 2, from First Take. What are your other gigs, Jemele Hill?
I do a little gym room with Bernie, you know. I'm basically up to the highest bidder still, so... It really doesn't matter.
What is your schedule like? I mean, you're just like flying around everywhere going on these TV shows. I'm worried about you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your concern. I'm just, this is sort of my cheap way of trying to build up enough mileage so I can eventually sit in first class on a regular basis. But beyond that, no, my schedule is pretty ridiculous. I'm gone, you know, a couple of days a week. I'm on call for First Take and First 10 or whatever, First and 10. And also do a lot of gym roam as well. I'm out in your neck of the woods in L.A. about every other month. That's how it's worked out. So
yeah, thanks for the calls.
You had a new baby.
I was trying to
be respectful.
I appreciate that. Well, you're my favorite multi-platform personality in the worldwide leader. I want you to know that.
Well, that's a huge compliment.
I know. And one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was because I want to talk about how you got to where you are, because you're pretty young. How old are you?
Do I really have to say?
No, you don't have to say.
Okay.
Give me a ballpark. Like, you're under 35.
Yes, I am under 35.
Yeah. Sure. So,
okay.
A lot's happened to you at a fairly early age. Where'd you go to college?
I went to Michigan State.
Were you there with any of the good teams?
No, actually, I was there when from 93 to 97, and the best team basketball-wise that we had was Sean Respert, Eric Snow, the team that was the two seed and lost to Weber State. That was as infamous as we got. I came pre-Mateen Flintstone era. That's when I was there. So.
When you were watching him at Michigan State, did you know that someday he would become the Black Jack Haley? In the NBA, on the bench, the premier bench warmer.
And he's so good at it, you know, cause he waves the towel. He has awesome energy, and, you know, I'm not shocked that this, you know, he's become, it seems, every time I look at the box score, he's like an NBDL legend right now, you know. He's got like, I looked up and saw one game, he had like 22 assists. It was ridiculous.
I have to say I was off on him. I thought he was going to be a decent pro because he was such a good leader in college, and you know, he got his teammates. So I thought there was enough there that at the very least he could be like a 15-minute-a-game guy, but I guess not.
Well,
he
couldn't shoot. But there have been other people who couldn't shoot, that like Avery Johnson. Avery Johnson was not a good shooter, as most people know, and he still was able to parlay that into something because of leadership. The problem was that Mateen also didn't have a whole lot of quickness, and I think that's what he really kind of derailed. And his jumper, I don't think it was as bad as people made it out to be. It just looked bad, and that was kind of another problem. But the good thing is that I spent 6 years at the Detroit Free Press. I actually got to cover my alma mater, so I covered that particular era. I wasn't a student while it was going on, and that was kind of neat to see, because Michigan State, unfortunately, the two best things that we keep getting known for is having a crappy football program, and we riot about once a year. So that's, you know, they broke that up a little bit.
And Tom Izzo. I'll throw Tom Izzo in there.
Yeah, no, and he's a good dude.
He's a good coach.
He's a good coach, good dude. Probably, you know, over my sort of, you know, interesting career, probably the best person I've ever covered.
So did you cover stuff when you were in college? Did you write for the school paper?
I did. I wrote for the State News.
Everything?
I did mostly news. I did 1 year of sports. In fact, my first beat was softball. That was my first beat.
Nice.
So did softball, did a little wrestling. For some reason, then I just sort of branching into all these Olympic sports. And I played fast-pitch softball in high school, so it made sense that that was a natural draw for me. And, you know.
Interesting. So you had the underhand, the quick underhand pitch thing?
I couldn't pitch, but I played a hell of a shortstop. I'm not even.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I was, I played short. I always wanted to be a catcher, but they were concerned that I could get trucked over because I was kind of bony in high school. So, but well, I had a hell of an arm.
But there's a rule that you have to be 200 pounds and above to be the catcher.
It is. And I thought that was terrible. And in fact, when, we had a catcher and she was a little bulkier, but she wasn't huge, but she had to miss a game and I filled in. Man, I gunned three people out. See, I was just like, I could have been the best catcher ever in the history of Mumford High School. This could have worked out.
So, Mumford High School? How do I know that?
You know that because Eddie Murphy wore a t-shirt in Beverly Hills.
That's right.
One and two. Yes. That's what we're known for.
I mean, not only known for, but you know. You know how they have, like, the world-famous deli and all that stuff? I would say that's a world-famous high school.
Well, that shirt that he wore, it is hanging in a glass case in the high school, just so you know. So
the actual shirt from the movie?
They like to make us believe that. I don't know if that's true, but that's what they're passing it off as. And, in fact, I was just wearing, the same style shirt yesterday because I have they presented me with a t-shirt. I went back to talk to some kids in my high school and they nicely gave me a shirt, probably the shirt they should have gave me when I paid my senior dues that I somehow never got, and so I guess somebody got on that.
So like I would buy that shirt. I feel like that shirt should be for sale. Maybe it is, maybe there's some website, but well, actually in the second movie, didn't he switch? He kind of wore like, what was it, a lion's jacket?
He did.
He had like a lion's letter jacket that he was like, they must have paid him to wear that.
Yeah, that's the only way I could imagine. And you know what, he added, somehow the movie still did well despite him wearing it. Now the third one didn't do so good because it was just, oh, that was a bad movie.
Well, you know my theory in the third one.
What?
Never happened. You just write it off. I live my life like it never happened. It's on cable. I pretend I don't know what it is and I just turn channels. Isn't that crazy though that he picked your high school? First of all, I can't believe you never told me that. I would have thought, in the emails we've exchanged, I would have thought that would have been the first thing you've told me.
You know what? You're right. I slipped up on that one. I mean, I guess because in Detroit, strangely enough, most people know my high school in Detroit because we've had a lot of really famous gospel singers. Oh, wait, you know what? You know who else went to my high school? Jerry Bruckheimer.
Really?
Yes. And as I tell people, because when I say that, and because I am from Detroit, people look at me like, Jerry Bruckheimer went to your school? And I was like, pre-white flight. I always have to say that, you know? Because
right.
I'm like, this is before the riot. So
yeah.
That's why, which is always funny, because if you go to my high school, you kind of look at, like, famous people or interesting people we've had that went to my high school. You'll see, like, a whole bunch of white people until, like, 69, and then it's, like, all black people.
Yeah, we had that in Boston. We had that, too. The mayor, when I was growing up, was named Ray Flynn, and he went to South Boston High. But then in 75, when they had the busing and they had all the riots, and it's just weird to think that he went to South Boston High now because they had no white people. But so it sounds like you did the same thing in Detroit. But so when I wrote the Axel Foley thing about how I made the decision after 25 years that he might have been gay in the movie, that's when you should have emailed me and dropped the Mumford High thing.
You're right. And then you would have perhaps come to a different conclusion. I don't know.
Where do you stand on that, Axel Foley, 25 years later, possibly?
I'm going to say I don't think that's true. But I will tell you, you talk about things you look back on now, and you've actually alluded to it in several columns. Man, every time I watch Top Gun, and I was like, how did I not know? You know what I mean? You watch that volleyball scene, and you're like, seriously, this should be in a gay porno, like honestly.
They in a movie called Sleep With Me with Quentin Tarantino, that's what illuminated me to it, because he has a whole monologue about, you know, how do people not see that this was what Top Gun was about. And I was the same as you. I never even occurred to me. But the thing with Beverly Hills Cop, like the smoking gun is the fact that the girlfriend, I forget what her name is, but they're in the hotel bed and she's like batting her eyelashes. I mean, she's clearly ready to go and he never steps in. But now after I wrote about that, it seems like the consensus is that back in the mid-80s, people weren't quite ready to see Eddie Murphy hook up with a white actress. And that was just the way it was back then. Nowadays, I think he steps in. If that movie's made in 2008,
right.
I think he steps in.
Right.
But even like in The Golden Child, when he was with, Charlotte Lewis.
The Asian woman, yeah.
Yeah, she was like Tia Carrere. Like, you don't, she was definitely like Asian, but you didn't, there's a lot of nationalities going on. You didn't know what she was, but, he never stepped in with that, which surprised me. And they had a scene where it's actually like an obvious cut where they go into his apartment, but then it's the next day. So I don't think back then, they must have just decided that America did not want to see Eddie even make out with anybody.
Well, didn't they do kind of the same thing with Denzel and Julia in, I can't remember the
Pelican Brief. They cut it out.
Yeah,
you're right.
Pelican Brief. Exactly.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
Oh, well, those are the times, Bill. Those are the times.
They well, I remember a big, there was a Dennis Haysbert, Michelle Pfeiffer movie. I can't remember the name of it, but that was a big deal. It was like an interracial romance and that was like, it was like pushing the envelope, and Hollywood had never gone there before. And now, you know, I don't think people would even think twice now.
Do you have a favorite of the interracial love stories?
I'm trying to think. You know, my wife's not going to like that you came on my podcast, and within 15 minutes we're talking about interracial romances. I think that's... She's going to say Freud would have had something to say about that. Hey, wait, so you go to the Detroit Free Press. From college?
No, before that I was at the News and Observer in Raleigh. And I was there for 2 years. Yeah, almost 2 years. And I covered a little bit of everything, hodgepodge. That was back when the ever-so-popular women's sports beat was kind of in vogue. So I did a lot of that. Covered a lot of UNC soccer titles. And so I started it because for a long time I really wanted to be kind of like an Olympics reporter. That was a major emphasis of mine. And then as I kind of progressed in my career, I kind of liked the idea of doing a bunch of different things. So I think that's why I've been able to kind of do the versatile thing at ESPN, because I covered Olympic sports. 6 years I covered a college beat, a lot of college football, a lot of college basketball. Did some did all the Pistons playoff run my whole 6 years at the Free Press. So got a little NBA in there. And
so during the like when Tayshaun showed up, like right around then, or Billups?
Yeah, I was there at the Free Press from 1999 to 2006. So yeah, I was there when they just you know, were kind of overcame the hump. And so it was Rick Carlisle.
Right.
Little George Irvin in there. Remember him?
Yeah. How did you get along with Jerry Stackhouse's posse?
You know,
it was significant.
I never had a problem with Stack. Like, he was really good to the media in Detroit. They liked him. The Pistons have not had, at least, you know, in my sort of immediate recollection, a lot of guys that have been bad locker room guys. This locker room they have now is fantastic.
So you like Sheed. You're on the Sheed bandwagon.
I am on the Sheed bandwagon. I think he is one of the most fascinating people in sports. If I could pick one person to hang out with for a couple of hours, it would be Rasheed Wallace. I mean, to be truthful, to not even gloss it up, he'd be on my I'd love to get drunk with that guy list.
Really?
Absolutely.
He seems like the greatest guy, and yet then you hear the people from Portland, and he just... I mean, it went like five levels beyond wearing out his welcome. Like, the people in Portland actively despise him and tell stories about, you know, he's at autograph sessions, like being mean to kids and stuff. And then you read like some of the other stuff, and his teammates swear by him. The people who get along with him, who covered him, say he's the all-time fascinating guy that covered, like you. Like, he's just like, he's an enigma. I don't know what to make of him. I feel like there hasn't been a definitive Rasheed Wallace feature that anybody's written that has gotten me to totally understand him.
Well, the thing to understand about him is, you know, like everybody knows, as a player, he hates to be the focal point, the centerpiece.
I
think it's very much that way as a person because, you know, in Portland, the most fascinating thing he did in Portland was he had his own radio show. He had his own hip-hop radio show, which was really good. He's very much into music. He's really smart. He loves art. I mean, he has all these different interests. But the moment that he's put in a position or a situation where he has to sort of present himself, this is just me, Sheed, I'm on display, he hates it, and he reacts very negatively to it. I'm not sure what in his past has made him that way, but whenever I got him one-on-one, it was just me and him, and we were just kind of shooting the crap, if you will, we had great conversations. We talked about hip-hop, like, forever, you know, because he's, like, so into it, and he likes that. But the moment a group starts to crowd around him, then he becomes like sort of like weird Sheed and, you know, nasty Sheed a little bit. So
I wonder if that has to do with in North Carolina, because that team kind of choked that he was on with Stackhouse. Like, I wonder if maybe there's some scars from that, because everybody blamed those guys. Those guys weren't real North Carolina guys and all that stuff.
I think that could probably be a byproduct of it. But it sounds like even in high school he was kind of that way, that he just didn't like to be the centerpiece. So I'm sure you have a athletes I'd love to get drunk with list. Who's on your list, Bill? Yeah, you got to have some good people.
You know, I got to say Brett Favre.
Really?
He seems like the kind of guy that you'd go ice fishing with him, and you'd be like, hey, Brett, will you bring some beer? And it'd just be the two of you, and he'd bring like five cases. But Brett, it's just two of us. I know, we'll get through this. Like, he just seems like he'd be the most fun guy. Obviously, you know, everybody in the Golden State Warriors, it would be a 12-way tie.
Oh, my God.
Especially if you could get me out with, like, Steven Jackson, Baron Davis, and, that would be it. Just those two. I'd like to go out with those two together. I think it would be really fun. Man, this is a loaded question. I almost don't want to answer this question. I feel like I need to spend like an hour thinking about it and then then announcing my top five list. Maybe I'll do that next week. But yeah, I think Rashid, from what I've read about him, I think he would be in the top 10 just because he seems like he's like the funniest dude. Like when he did that Christmas thing that ended up on YouTube, I just thought that was
hilarious.
And
the stuff like that that leads me to believe, and even funnier or as funny as that, you ever seen him before the game when he's hyping up up the team? How hysterical is that?
Well, that was one of my favorite moments of the season, a game I went to, the first Pistons game in Boston, and we're doing the whole Jumbotron fireworks, all that crap, and meanwhile, he's in the middle of a circle just doing his thing, you know, trying to get those guys not to focus on the video of all the old Celtics and all that stuff, and he was just trying to distract them and do sheet things, and it was just really interesting to watch the command he had over those guys, you know? He's clearly the leader of that team.
He is, and that's why I've always found it very misleading when people keep saying, oh, Chauncey Billups is the leader of the team. There is no way that is possible because their temperature follows Rashid. I mean, if he's disinterested, they're disinterested. When he's on fire, it's really hard to beat them. And I think
but that's what was so funny about the Ben Wallace thing when the Bulls signed him. They're like, they needed his leadership, and it's like everybody who covered that team or was around that team was like, that guy was not a leader. He was like an enigma, differently from Rashid. Like you just couldn't read him at all.
Right.
And moody.
No, he was. Ben Wallace is. It's kind of deceptive. I feel, you know, he has good media relationships, but he, some of the things like he said about Flip Saunders and even Larry Brown, I mean, he has an element of disrespect for coaches that is, you know, not really talked about because the way that he got to the NBA is so, you know, so makes people feel so good, you know, because they're like, oh, here's a guy who, you know, was discounted, worked his way in. They love his story, but I think there's definitely, you know, there's a little diva-ishness there in Ben Wallace. And I think his attitude was also part of the reason why, you know, his last couple of years they failed. So.
Well, you know, the other thing is maybe it makes you wonder why that's why it took him so long to get to the NBA. Maybe there was more going on behind the scenes. You know, it wasn't just about his basketball ability. Maybe it was a little bit of a head case.
But though you have to admit, I mean, considering still when you look at how he's playing now, which I think in a way is kind of indicative to, you know, probably how he was most of his career as opposed to, you know, those couple years with Detroit where he really established himself.
Yeah.
I can't believe that you can be in the NBA that long and really airball as many free throws as he has. Like, it is amazing to me, like, when you at least hit the rim, I mean, you don't have to make them, but he airballs at least, I would guess, 10 free throws a year. I'm serious.
I would just think it would be one of those things where you were so humiliated by it that it would be all you thought about and that you just would shoot 500 a day to make sure that when the situation came, you wouldn't be embarrassed. And instead, some of these guys, I don't know how many Shaq shoots, but the way it's been explained to me is anybody over 6'9", it can be a complete crapshoot because of the angle that the ball is released from their chest to the rim.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And that if, like, you look at somebody like Carlos Boozer, just the way he shoots, so he's releasing the ball, and it's at about the 7-foot mark compared to the rim, so just the trajectory has to be higher, and throw in his release, and it's screwed up. But the thing that doesn't make sense is, like, somebody like, I don't know, like David Robinson.
Oh, right.
I don't know what his free throw, I just remember him being a pretty good free throw shooter. But he always looks smooth, so I don't know. The free throw thing is something that I feel like we're going to figure out 10 years from now, and then all of a sudden everybody will shoot well. Because like back in the old days, they did underhand.
Yeah, that's true. Well, but like Dwight Howard, supposedly with Shaq, it's because his hand size is so big that it makes it very difficult for him to, you know, sort of get a very consistent motion down.
I don't buy that, though, because if you hold a tennis ball, it's easier to shoot a tennis ball into a basket than a basketball.
Good point.
I don't know. I don't get that. Did you deal with Dwight Howard at all? Were you still in Orlando at that time or no?
Yeah. I mean, he's been, you know, pretty consistently bad with his free throws.
But no, I mean as a behind the scenes, as a person and as a source and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah, behind the scenes, Dwight is he's a really, really good guy, very naive in a lot of ways.
Too nice, maybe?
Too nice, yeah. And this is, I don't know if you ever saw that ESPN Sports Nation poll that was done about who would you rather have if you were an expansion team and Dwight Howard and Chris Paul were the top two players. Who would you have? And I said Chris Paul. And I know common sense, you always go with the big guy because you can't duplicate 7 feet and certainly not Dwight Howard's athletic ability. But he doesn't have presence. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
His game doesn't rub off on his teammates like it did with Shaq, where Shaq could make guards better. Dwight Howard, like, basically just learned how to pass out a double team like 3 weeks ago. So, you know, it's like he's just not that kind of transcendent personality, whereas I think Chris Paul is, where his game does rub off on his teammates and his energy and his leadership. And Dwight Howard is going to be, he's a max player with complementary characteristics.
You just also described David Robinson.
Yep.
And that's what I've always made the comparison of those two guys, because I think they're really nice guys that would not rip your jugular out to win a game. And you saw it in the last game, game five, you know, in Orlando, they lost in five, but that series really could have gone seven, and they just didn't know how to close games. But there was that pivotal moment with like a minute and a half left. There's a loose ball. Dwight Howard's the biggest guy in the court. If he goes for that ball, people are going to bounce off him, and instead he kind of eased up, and somebody else got it. And I just thought that was a symbol of where he is in his career.
Yeah, you know, I think Orlando, and he's taken them, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm not giving him any credit, because, I mean, he's certainly taken them, you know, pretty far in the short period of time that he's been there. But, you know, you look at those guards, and, you know, I don't know, I know the Rashard Lewis thing. Everybody is harking on that here, and he's received a lot of criticism. But
nobody saw that coming.
I know, right? Exactly. I mean, it's just like, it's hard to not give the Magic crap for the fact that they could have, to me, they should have saved the money. Just save the money.
Yeah.
You know, instead of paying that guy $118 million, you got to be kidding me.
Well, I wrote about this a little bit. It's a situation I don't think people really understand. Like, GMs, their goal is to keep their jobs.
Right.
Their goal isn't like, I'm not trying to build a contender for the next 12 years, or I'm not doing what's the best for this team. For the most part, they're going to do what it takes to keep their job and make sure that they are in there for the next 3, 4, 5 years, whatever. So Otis Smith does this, overpays Rashard Lewis to make sure he gets him, like ridiculously overpays him. Overpays him by $40 more than what he's worth to make sure he gets him, because he knows if he has Howard, Rashard Lewis, and Turkoglu, that those three guys will be enough to put them in the playoffs and he will keep his job. And it won't be until 2 years from now that people realize, hey, wait a second, we have no money to get other players. Like, our point guards are terrible. What do we do?
Yeah.
But by that time, he will have been paid for 2, 3 more years. And, you know, I just don't think people realize how much a GM can affect the fortunes of a franchise just by being selfish. Because I saw it with Chris Wallace in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
His owner told him, look, I need you to cut the salaries by $2 million. We end up trading for Vin Baker, who was a drunk.
Right.
And it's one of those things, like, if your owner is telling you to screw up the team to keep your, then quit. Have some pride.
Yeah.
The Pau Gasol trade, I was watching I went to the Lakers game last night. They should show Chris Wallace's photo in the Jumbotron every time Pau Gasol scores with, like, you know, put him on a big birthday cake or something. But, and by the way, that game last night, Jazz Lakers game five. We talk about Dwight Howard and does he have that extra, and Chris Paul does. All those guys in that game, it was such a competitive game. Everybody on the floor had gonads.
Yeah, it was a very well played game.
Oh.
It was unbelievable. And you know, that's another person, you know, talk about the comparison. It's the Darren Williams, Chris Paul. I know people, because of this whole, you know, because Chris Paul's unbelievable season, they've kind of awarded that to Darren Williams, to Chris Paul. But I don't know. Darren Williams is, I prefer bigger point guards. And I always thought that he had the ability to be the next Jason Kidd, but a much better shooter. With his body, you know, he just controls a game with his size, and a lot of guards in the league can't do that. But at the same time, I have to wonder a little bit about his leadership somewhat, because I didn't understand how this team can be so schizophrenic as they were during the regular season. And maybe it's just a Jerry Sloan thing. He's grating on people, you know, and those type of situations. Why did it feel like to me Utah didn't have as good of a season as I thought they were going to have?
It took them 2 months to come together, because they didn't really start coming together until the Korver trade. And I think from beginning of January on, I think they did have a good season. But I think the main thing we're starting to realize as the second round goes along is that the NBA is back to where it was in the mid-'80s, where teams protected home court in the 80s.
Right.
You beat somebody on the road in the 80s, and it was a huge freaking deal. You know, it was like, wow, we went in there and we won, because everybody was good. And when you have all good teams, the crowd is going to push a really good team to a level where they can't be beat. And I think in the second round, what is it, like 19 out of 20?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you cannot do what the Pistons used to do, would be, you know, in the earlier part of the decade, where they blow a home game and know that they could just go on the road and win in Indiana or New Jersey or wherever. I don't think the league works like that anymore. Like, these teams, like that Lakers team, Utah played well last night. Lakers still won.
They played well enough to beat them. There's no question about it.
Which makes me wonder, like, if the Celts, you know, if they can just protect home court, maybe we can win the title going 0-12 on the road.
I would tell you, I really thought, and it certainly looked that way early on, because LeBron had, what, 23 at the half?
Yep.
I was just like, you know, just following the script of what happened to Detroit last year, I just thought the Celtics were really setting themselves up for that to happen again. But, you know, you, as I've said to you in our emails, like, you said that LeBron had a great shot to get back to the finals, just because, you know, one mega superstar can beat, you know, three very good players. And I would not want to go to game seven with that guy. I really wouldn't.
No. And we saw it in the first half, and last night, and we're recording this on a Thursday, game five was last night. The first half, it just looked like he had it in his eyes. Like, you know, Jay-Z and Beyonce are there, and he just, he's in the garden. He's thinking 63-point MJ game. And I think Kenny Smith actually made a really good point. LeBron actually got too caught up in the whole, I'm going to do the MJ 63 thing, mm-hmm. and kind of got out of his game. Like, he was kind of went a little Kobe on us, started looking for his own shot. And they really weren't the same team in the second half, because the Celts were basically like, well, we're going to put three guys on you, and you're going to – and he didn't really know how to totally adjust to it. But in game seven, you're right. Because I think Cleveland's going to win Friday night. So in game seven, if he can kind of find that balance, we're in trouble. No question.
And it looks like a couple former Celtics there. Delonte West, I mean, he's playing very well in this series. And you know, I'm not a huge Delonte West fan, but I thought he played really well yesterday. And if he had been, as you said, incorporated more into the game late, you know, he had some steals he came up with at the end. If he does that maybe a little bit more consistently with LeBron's help throughout the game, then they, I think they really might have made that interesting. But the only thing that bothers me about, you know, Cleveland, other than Anderson Varejao, who I constantly look at like, I can't believe you're in the NBA, but it's that they're a hard team to figure out, because they're so specialized. You know, you have Daniel Gibson, okay, he does threes. You know, you have Joe Smith, he'll give you a little back-to-back-to-the-basket presence, or, you know, a couple buckets here and there. Savvy vet guy. Okay, you got Ben Wallace, good for a couple of defensive possessions. They're so specialized that it's hard to give them respect as an entire team. And I think I've stopped piling on his supporting cast as much as I did before, because I realize they're not as bad as everybody makes them out to.
No.
You know, Joe Smith, you know, people forget, maybe not a great number one pick, but he was once the number one pick. And, I mean, it's the reason he's been in the league.
And Z's good. Z you can go to.
Yeah.
The Celts finally realized last night that if they went small down the stretch, that the Cavs couldn't play Z. And the Cavs had to respond by putting Sasha Pavlovich in for Z. And
yeah, where's that guy been?
I know. Well, yeah. And he was looking for $50 million before the season. So if you had to bet your life on it, Detroit-Boston, who do you think comes out of that series?
I'm going with the Pistons, Bill. You know this. You know I'm going to go with it. And that's not an emotional pick. I swear it's not. Even though
I know you're not a homer. I mean, I'm a homer, but you're not.
Well, actually, you're not that bad.
No, I'm only realistic with the Celtics. Just because I care about the NBA so much, I'm usually like pretty fair for the most part. Although I really regret the KG MVP pick now, and you know the mistake I made with that. I stand by everything I wrote, but the problem is I'm watching that Celtics team 82 games, so I'm stockpiling all these things like KG does this, KG does that. But if I watched Chris Paul for 82 games, I probably would have been convinced he was the MVP.
But
you know?
You didn't make a mistake, because if you go by the criteria, I mean, look at the win differential. Obviously, they go from being kind of a middling to bad defensive team to being one of the top three in the NBA. I don't agree with the choice, just because I thought, you know, Chris Paul just did something.
I should have picked Chris Paul.
But I think KG deserves to be strongly in the argument just based off how he turned the team around. I mean,
yes.
That is what an MVP is supposed to do. And what did they go, 22-5 in the West? I mean, come on.
I'm gonna add a wrinkle to the criteria next year that somebody, a reader, suggested that I thought was smart. If one of the wrinkles is whoever you pick, the fans from the other team who think that their guys should win, at the very least, they should be able to say, all right, I don't agree with you, but I see it.
Right.
And the fans from L.A. and New Orleans who watch Chris Paul and Kobe, they just didn't see the KG thing. I mean, I made my case. I fought for it. And people were just like, you know what? You're a homer. And I don't mind being called a homer, but I see their point, because if I had watched Kobe for 82 games, maybe I would have talked myself into a lot of the things he does. So I do think Chris Paul, the more I'm thinking about it, I think Chris Paul should have gotten the vote. And also, who is more important than Chris Paul? I mean, seriously, you replace him with Jameer Nelson, and what the hell happens to that team? It's a disaster.
Yeah, and you look at how he's raised the level of the games of the people around him. I mean, David West has been consistent, and he's been very underrated for a while, and people are just now getting – but he has taken him to a super – he took him from underrated to all-star. You know, you see people's individual games making leaps, and you know what impresses me about Chris Paul? He can go from fast to slow so quickly, it's mind-boggling. I mean, his speed is very elusive and easy to fall in love with, but his slowdown game is ridiculous.
I know, from a spiritual standpoint, like just if you care about basketball and you care about seeing things that you're not used to seeing, he hits the mark the most times for me in terms of just like I'm watching just to make sure I don't miss something he does. Which was, Jordan was a lot like that. I don't know if LeBron's quite there yet. I mean, he's there definitely in the runaway train on the fast break standpoint.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Offensively, he's pretty predictable. You can kind of guess what he's going to do. Chris Paul, I have no idea what he's going to do. He's coming down on a fast break. You're watching. It's like watching Bobby Orr in the 70s or Gretzky or somebody, like when they had the puck in the open ice. And you really didn't know what was going to happen.
I wonder with LeBron, and this is, I know this may probably sound silly to a lot of people. I do question whether or not he wants to be great. And like you, you know, you've said it many times in your columns that when, you know, he was asked what he most wanted and he said global icon. I mean, I question it because I don't see, you know, like Kobe every summer, he adds a wrinkle. Okay, he needed to lose 20 pounds because he felt like he was being too hard on his knees, so he did it. He needed the fadeaway, so he added it. He needed, you know, whatever he needs, he adds.
MJ did the same.
MJ was the same way, right. What is LeBron adding? Like, he's still the same player he was 3 years ago.
It's a great question, and I was just talking about this with somebody. The fact that he hasn't developed a post-up game yet is inexcusable. Because
I totally agree.
Because nobody could handle him on the low post, and he's such a good passer that you wouldn't be able to double-team him. At the very least, at this point, he should have, like, the embryonic stages of that Jordan follow-away that Jordan used to shoot, where he would fade back just enough that you couldn't block it. He should at least be showing that he's trying to learn how to shoot that shot, and he doesn't have it.
After what happened to him against San Antonio in the finals, I'm a little stunned that he is coming back with basically the same game. I mean, San Antonio, the Celtics are just following what San Antonio did. I mean, the Wizards did too to some degree, but not with a whole lot of success, I don't think. But because they don't have the same defensive commitment. But, you know, they're doing the same thing. They're putting their – cutting him off to go to the paint, them turning him in the jump shooter. And what really disappoints me, the other night, I think it was game four, he took some horrendous shots. I mean, just bad. You know, where he's fading back and launching three-pointers. He's not a good three-point shooter, but
terrible.
Like he's terrible. And when they dare him to do it, it's like he takes it to try to prove, no, I really can do this. And I'm like, dude, if you haven't worked on that shot, you need to just dump it. So I'm
did you hear Kenny Smith last night?
No, what did he say about him?
Kenny made a great point. He said LeBron does one of two things. Either he pulls up for the three-pointer, the 20-footer, or he goes to the basket hard. And he doesn't have that third thing that Jordan used to have where he'd start to go to the basket hard, he'd make the 15-footer, or he'd get to his spot on the foul line, or he had the post-up game. He has no other element to his game. So if you can – and what he was saying was the Celtics had decided, we're not going to let you shoot that three-pointer anymore, and we're going to put three guys on you if you try to go to the basket. So what else can you do? And he can't do anything.
No, which is, again, and it's just because, oh, Doc Rivers figured that out. Clearly, Greg Popovich figured that out. Why I can't completely get on the Flip Saunders bandwagon for not figuring that out. So
LeBron's defense, he did host the ESPYs last year, so he didn't have a lot of time to work on the turnaround. So you got to cut him slack because that was important that, you know, he was involved. He had to shoot some bits, so, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to, like, not give him a break, but, you know, you were talking about, you know, Pistons, Celtics, Pistons, Cavs, whatever. If you're Detroit, you'd much rather see Boston because I think with Cleveland, just honestly, I think since LeBron has overcome the mental hurdle of beating Detroit, it's going to be real impossible to put that guy out of the playoffs. He knows what he can do. And, you know, Detroit, I just don't think they have the same amount of defensive commitment that they had maybe when they had Larry Brown. They can be lulled into just letting him do what he wants to do. So, and their role players, they play, Barisal looks like a damn all-star every time he plays against Detroit. So,
right.
I think that's a much more troublesome series for them. With Boston, it would be better for them because they'll be mentally engaged in all the games. They'll have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder because they know a lot of people want to see Boston in the finals. From a motivational standpoint, it works a whole lot better for them.
Well, you also have a lot of relationships on both sides that adds to the competitiveness because, you know, Billups and KG are best friends.
Right.
Rashid and KG have been playing against each other for 13, 14 years. Rip Hamilton and Ray Allen, UConn guys, they've been, you know, Ray Allen took Rip Hamilton under his wing. So you have all these, you have Cassell, who knows everybody in the league, P.J. Brown. You got all these intertwining things that I think will make for a really cool series if it happens. And it's the one team I don't see the Pistons letting up against because the Pistons have those stinkers where they just don't show up. I don't see them doing that against the Celtics because there's too much at stake and too many – I just don't see it. That's what scares me because I think they can win one game in Boston, which means that the Celtics to win the series would have to win game 3, 4, 6 in Detroit.
Right.
That's tough.
Right.
Yeah. If my life depended on it, I think I would bet on Detroit.
Well, and that's the other thing. You talk about having an advantage. It's, you know, Detroit knows who they're going to go to in the fourth quarter. Almost certainly it'll be Chauncey Billups. And, you know, so they kind of have it figured out in that perspective. And I think that's an advantage over the Celtics, who at times don't really seem to have that figured out. And I tell you, if I were a Celtics fan, I would be tearing out whatever hair I had every time KG shot that lame 18-foot fadeaway. That is just, I hate to see him do that. It gets Barisal, all people. You mean to tell me he can't blow past Anderson Barisal
or
get a little more creative around the hoop?
Did you see KG do the drop step on Delonte West on the mismatch and dunk on him? See, he can do it. If he had shot the turnaround over Delonte West, I'm just telling you right now, that would have been it. I would have punched myself and become unconscious. Because, and I was really like, as soon as they had the mismatch, I was like, if he shoots far away, I'm going to have a conniption. But thank God he did the drop step. I'm still trying to figure him out. I got to be honest. It's such a strange thing to have your best guy on the team have to be constantly told that he's the best guy on the team and that you need him to come through because you look at Duncan and he just has that switch like, uh-oh, they need me this game. I got to get 23 rebounds. KG doesn't have the switch. It's weird.
No,
it's like he wasn't born with it.
Well, and this is what people have to kind of understand. You know, it's a reason he didn't get out the playoffs for, what, 6-7 years? Okay,
right.
In the first round. You know, it's a reason that didn't happen. It's a reason why there's even a reason why Paul Pierce hasn't, you know, had a little bit more. But he doesn't – Paul Pierce – This and I know they beat Detroit. I actually covered that series. They beat Detroit, I think, in 2002 it was.
Yes.
That was a
rock fight, that series.
Wasn't it?
It was like a 66-64 game,
yeah.
Right? 66-64 final?
Yeah. That was the basketball that set it back. Trust me. But can you think of, like, I was sitting up here thinking of this, like, has Paul Pierce had, like, a defining playoff game that I could say, like, oh, yeah, I remember when he did this. I mean, like, obviously, you know, though it's not in the same realm, you can say, okay, LeBron had, you know, dropped 48 on Detroit. Everybody has a definitive playoff game.
Well, he does have one. He does have one. But we immediately forgot it because of what happened the next game. Game 3 of the Nets series in 2002.
Oh, you're right.
When they came back from 27.
Yeah,
I was there.
I totally forgot about that game. Yeah.
What happened was he put the team on his back, and it was really one of the happiest games I've ever been to. Like, everybody just went out and got hammered afterwards. We're so delighted that Paul Pierce had made the leap. And then the next game, he missed the game-tying free throw. Down, I think 4 seconds left, down 2, he gets fouled and bricked the first one. And I don't think he's been the same since. I mean, he's definitely come back a little last year and this year, but I think that really set him back because he was ready to make the leap, and it just never happened because of that game. Too bad.
And you, I think as I said the other day, you have a team with 3 really good Robins and no Batman. So.
Well, it's funny. Last night I was talking to my buddy J-Bug who went to the game. We were talking before the game, and I was saying the key guy in this game is Rondo. As weird as that sounds, Rondo is the one guy who's too young to be afraid, who just has young legs, and who has this like weird confidence about himself that he shouldn't have. But he really does think like he's the best guy on the court, which could be a problem. But last night he, you know, controlled the game on both ends. It was one of the best games he's played. That's why I wrote about him 3 weeks ago because, yeah, he's going to have some bad games. He's 22. He's a second-year point guard. But his upside is that he has a nasty edge to his game that the top 3 guys don't have.
How telling was it that I think when they lost, I want to say when they lost in Cleveland, that he, I think Rondo took the most shots. Yeah,
right,
and
he did it because everybody else was scared, and he knew, like, you know, I don't think he's totally put it together yet, but at least he can sense, like, uh-oh, I got to do something here, and that's what made it so frustrating that Doc, you know, is playing Sam Cassell for 9 straight minutes. Rondo's 22 years old. Rondo should be playing 44 minutes a game in this series. He has young legs. He's fine. He probably went out last night after the game and was out till 3 in the morning. I mean, this is somebody that does not need to be spot rested by Sam Cassell. Just put him out there. I'm getting mad.
Yeah, I could tell. It was like a temper just starting up a little bit. But, you know, you have him not being unafraid, as you said. And I also thought it was kind of interesting that the person who spoke to the team after, you know, losing at Cleveland was James Posey. Now, I realize he has a ring, so I understand from that perspective. But shouldn't it be KG? I mean, shouldn't it be him or, you know, saying something as opposed to just kind of looking there like somebody just, you know, kind of shot him in the hip? I mean, he's just so...
I know. I said this to somebody yesterday. I really thought they were going to lose yesterday, and I said, you know, you look at, like, the old bunker analogy, like, who do I want to be in a bunker with?
Right.
And you watch that Lakers-Utah game. All those guys who are on the court at the end of the game, all of them are bunker guys.
6-7 guys, yeah.
Yeah, guys that when the going gets tough, they're going to get into and raise their game. And on the Celtics team, for me, it was Rondo and Posey. And I don't trust KG in a bunker. I want to see him do it a couple of times. I definitely don't trust Pierce, and I don't trust Ray Allen.
Right.
So we needed our bunker guys to come through. Posey didn't really have a good game last night, but Rondo did. In Cleveland, it'll be interesting. Because at some point they're going to have to win on the road for people to take this team seriously, I think.
Well, which do you think is more likely to happen, them winning on the road or someone beating them in Boston?
Someone beating them in Boston.
That's what I would say, too.
Actually, I do think in the Detroit series they have the X factor of Detroit winning one of the first 2 games at home, winning game 3, kind of easing up, thinking, all right, we got this team, and then maybe we steal game 4.
Right.
I can see that happening. But with Flip Saunders and Doc Rivers involved, really anything's possible. You can't predict.
Oh, is that not going to be like the greatest NBA coaching playoff matchup of all time?
Well, I thought Mike Brown and Flip Saunders was one for the ages last year. Now you throw Doc Rivers in here, and who knows? It's going to be great.
Last year will be worse, where you saw, oh, I don't know, coaches trying to make an adjustment like every three games as opposed to...
Yeah.
It's like Flip doesn't watch the film from the last game. He watches a film from like four games ago. You're like, what are you doing? And he adjusts to that, you know? It takes him so long to think of an adjustment. It's unbelievable.
It's really not... I'm convinced coaching, really not rocket science sometimes. Like,
yeah.
Rondo's 22. He's probably capable of playing 40 minutes at home with a crowd cheering everything he does. I'm going to say he's going to have enough adrenaline at age 22 to play 40 minutes. Stuff like, you know, putting the ball in Rondo's hands because they kept leaving him open. Not rocket science. I mean, it makes sense. Yeah, maybe we'll run some pick and rolls, get him involved. And so I don't know. I'm convinced football is the only sport I think where coaching really, truly, totally matters. And in basketball and baseball, the coach – or the manager, it seems like they can just screw it up more than they can help.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and in the NBA, I mean, coach, you only really have to coach, honestly, especially if you have a good team. Like, wait, how long is the playoff? Like 3-4 weeks? I mean, you basically have to coach in the playoffs. And that's only if the game is close, you know, in the last, you know, 4 to 5 minutes. And
speaking of coaches, last night at Lakers Jazz, in the crowd, sitting behind one of the baskets, Mr. North Turner.
Oh, no.
I almost went up to him. I really almost did. I was fighting myself off. Because it was an amazing crowd. Because Nicholson's there. You had all these weird celebrities like Tobey Maguire. And then randomly, sitting courtside, wearing a Michael Strahan Blue Giants jersey.
What?
John Favreau.
Oh, my God.
Are you kidding me? John Favreau? Really? Do you think, like, I mean, seriously, do you think he knew who Eli Manning was 5 months ago? Do you think he had any idea that Peyton Manning had a brother? And what would possess somebody to wear a Strahan Blue Giants jersey to a Lakers Jazz game when you're sitting courtside?
Yeah, that's kind of bizarre. I mean, I don't even think bizarre captures it.
No, and he's, coincidentally enough, he directed Iron Man, which has been this huge smash hit, and he's a red hot.
Did you see that yet?
I have not seen that yet. It's on my list.
I thought it was unbelievable. Robert Downey Jr., I tell you, that is one, I mean, talk about a guy who's obviously been through a lot, but I was just like, man, hardest working crackhead ever. Hardest working crackhead.
I think we all got a little scared, though, when that movie started making a lot of money. Like, oh, watch Robert. Keep an eye on him.
But, no, exactly. It's worth it, though. It really is a really, really good movie.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, if you're the hot director du jour in Hollywood and you score courtside seats to a Lakers game, don't wear the Strahan jersey.
No.
Wear a nice blue blazer with a shirt. Leave your shirt tucked out. Wear some nice pants. I don't get it. I almost wanted. The other funny thing was they do the Hollywood Nights montage. Have you been to a Lakers game? Where they show all the celebrities?
I've been to one, but it's been. I've only seen one game ever at Staples.
Oh, well, it's an experience to go to a playoff game. You should go. But they do a montage with Bob Seger's Hollywood Night, Detroit's own Bob Seger. And they play Hollywood Nights, and they show all the celebrities in the crowd. So they show, you know, Tobey Maguire, David Beckham, Nicholson. And Favreau was watching the Jumbotron, kind of secretly hoping. Didn't happen. I think he was upset. I think he might have called his agent right afterwards. But
well, you know, I guess along the same veins, what I always find hilarious is when TNT, you know, when they're doing the broadcast and it's that time where, okay, we're going to show the celebrities. Don't you love it how they always go to the celebrities that are on their shows? But what's the worst is that you don't know these people. Like, they showed a dude from The Closer, which I've never watched, and maybe it really is the number one drama on cable television. I don't know. But they showed this dude, and they're like, oh, and look who's in the crowd tonight. I'm like, who the hell is that? And they show the cast from, like, House of Perry, or what the hell is that called? House of Pain, that's what it's called. Yeah, I was like,
Tyler Perry's House of Pain?
Yeah, Tyler Perry's House of Pain.
The network that started that shenanigans was Fox.
Oh, my God.
Fox was the one. They started doing that when they got baseball, and they'd have some terrible show that was about to start on Fox, and they'd be like, hey, coming back from an, you know, commercial. Hey, look who's in the crowd. It's the cast from Skin.
Right.
What?
It's like, who are these people?
Yeah.
Totally. It's bad because you can't, I mean, come on, like, who would you know from the TNT series? It's all stuff that's in syndication, you know? This is an NBC where they're showing, like, you know, Steve Carell or, you know, people from The Office, which I'm sure a lot of people would know, but come on. I don't know the dude, the third actor on The Closer. That was bad.
Well, we shouldn't make fun of other networks because we're not allowed to make fun of our own. Hey, what are your NBA playoff, if at gunpoint, who are you picking in the finals and who are you picking to win?
The original preseason pick was Detroit San Antonio, everybody's favorite final. Mm-hmm. The I'm waffling now pick is LA Detroit.
Yeah,
LA Detroit.
I will say this. If San Antonio can get by New Orleans, I think they beat the Lakers. But
yeah, I agree.
If New Orleans gets by, I think the Lakers beat them. So it's weird. It's going to be the rock, paper, scissors thing. I think that's where we're headed for this.
Well, I take it, you know, I think it was, may have been Charles Barkley. I'm not totally sure, or Kenny, but the winner, a lot of people, them specifically, believe that the winner of the Lakers-Utah series will come out of the West. You know,
I don't agree with that because they have nobody to guard Duncan on the Lakers. Pau Gasol, you know, it's almost like he's now become overrated because he's been so huge for this Lakers team, and he's a great offensive player. He's fantastic. Defensively, he's an abomination.
Right.
So to think that when he and DJ Mbenga and Ronnie Turiaf are the three guys you have guarding Tim Duncan in a playoff series, I cannot call you the favorites. I will say it's a coin flip. It's 50-50, whatever. But I think the Lakers, the Spurs match up a little better with the Lakers than vice versa. Because at least they can throw Bowen and all their Ginobili, all their swingmen, they can throw on Kobe and just take turns on him. And they can guard Gasol by himself. You know, and that's why the Lakers lost last night.
Yeah.
Because they could not guard Gasol down the stretch. He was getting 5-foot shots easy with no hand in his face. So.
Yeah, one thing about him that I love in watching him play is he stays around the basket. Okay, he's not trying to...
He knows what he is.
He knows exactly what he is. And he's a really underrated offensive rebounder. But, I think I'm gonna waffle and say L.A. Detroit. But I would actually pick L.A. because I think, they're better, like significantly better than Detroit, but you figure, you know, I don't know, I think Detroit has won their last two titles two of the last three titles against the Lakers. You figure that L.A. is going to be due sometime. You got to switch it up a little bit.
It's a nice history. You got the 20-year anniversary of the series that the league fixed so the Lakers could win the 88 finals. The last 3 seconds of Game 7, fans coming on the court as Detroit's trying to tie the game. Magic knocks Isaiah into the scorer's table, no call. Nice to get some revenge for that.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I think they gotta be due sometime. So who's your pick? Are you going? Are you riding with Boston into it?
I think Detroit makes the finals, and I think however the San Antonio New Orleans, it's the rock, as I said, rock paper scissors. So whatever San Antonio, I think wins tonight. So then that comes down to Game 7, and as much as I love this Hornets team, Game 7, different animal. You get the Spurs have been in a bunch of big games. They had the experience, and the Hornets have not. So, you know, you can – who knows? Maybe Chris Paul gets so fired up for the game, like he shoots his wad by the end of the first half and is not the same guy. So you just don't know. I know with the Spurs. I know what I'm getting with them.
I feel bad picking against New Orleans just from the perspective that every time I do, they just show me – okay, I keep doubting this team, and I'm running out of reasons to do it. You know, I keep saying, right. experience. And then what do? You know, they beat the snot out of San Antonio, which I thought was, you know, one of those deceptive game fives that are really game sevens. I'm worried about the Spurs. I'll be perfectly honest because
I'm with you.
The way they keep coming out and they keep having these dreadful third quarters and, you know, it seems like Byron Scott, a coach who I'll admit I had a different opinion of. He's
much maligned. Yeah, I agree.
Yes, much maligned, and he's been excellent this entire year. And him making the subtle adjustments to delay the double teams on Duncan, I mean, pretty much was adjustment that basically allowed them to win the game. So
I will say the difference with him versus Flip or Doc Rivers or Mike Brown, Scott, you know, whatever, tactically you can say whatever you want about him, but he does seem to have a command over those guys. Like those guys,
yeah,
you can see
they
it.
They respect
when,
him.
Yeah, you can see it when in the huddles, the way they listen to him, the things, the way he interacts with them. He's clearly the coach. Whereas, I watch Doc Rivers or I watch Flip, and it's like seeing the substitute teacher. You know, the guy is a little frazzled, little like, gee, I hope nobody notices I'm in over my head. And I actually thought Byron Scott was a little like that when he was on those 2002-2003 Nets teams, but now he is much more in command, it seems.
Well, he probably, if you think about it, because he had Jason Kidd, who I think is like one of the more underrated coach killers of all time.
Oh, just talking about that last night with Mike, my friend that I went to the game with. Because he's so unselfish on the court, people assume he's like that in every aspect.
And it's completely.
And he's a terrible guy.
Yeah, it's totally not like that at all. I mean, he throws his coaches under the bus at literally every opportunity.
All-time coach killer.
What he is, you think, or?
He's my starting point guard on the coach killing team.
Oof. Well, if we're just talking about basketball, I don't know. I mean, I'd have put Michael Vick in the top five as well.
Oh, if you're doing cross athletes.
Yeah, if you're just doing, you know, coach killers across the board, Michael Vick would have definitely made my top five.
If I was doing a hoops team, I don't know.
Starberry for sure. I mean, Stephon Marbury. He's got to be Coach Killer Hall of Fame. You got to be kidding me on that one.
This could be a good idea for Ice-T for a comeback to remake Cop Killer as Coach Killer. And just show video of Jason Kidd and all these other guys. Hey, we have to let you go because we're at the one-hour mark. And we never got to talk about, I guess we'll do it next time. The whole females and sports writing and some of the stuff you had to overcome and some of the prejudices that were in there about women in the locker room, because I'm fascinated by that stuff. And let's get to that next time.
Oh yeah, we'll definitely do it. I'll regale you. You know, you don't have to make me sound like a PBS Eyes on the Prize special, by the way.
No, I don't want to. But I just think, you know, it's a very strange industry for a female to be in, and I don't think people fully realize that. You know, your job is to interact with players and work these sources and get information, and it's a male dominated industry. And you know, I just think you would have some interesting stories. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you would be right. I got a few.
We'll figured you have a few.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, Bill. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate joining you. You're one of my favorites. I just can't tell you how much respect I have for you.
Thank you. And same for you. And I love having you on. And next time I have you on, I will hopefully not be bitching about the Celtics-Pistons playoffs.
Okay, we'll do, Bill.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Target to sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.